IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 56 of the Killing It Podcast. This is Carl. I'm joined by, as always, by Dave and Ryan. And we are, at least for the next few shows, at home. So I haven't gone anywhere. I haven't gone to Thailand. I haven't gone to Cambodia. So
hey, all of our status is renewed for another year. Pretty much everybody. Pretty much every major.
I did finally confirm, like check mark, all my airlines, all my hotels, all my rental cars, they've all extended it into 2022. I appreciate them for doing that, but I am sure that there are other questions that will need to be answered. But, you know, for the time being, we are, we're working from home, but we're also working on home. And I don't know about you guys, there are certain handy people in this world who love a home project and they want to get a saw and a hammer and build some stuff.
Are you not one of those?
I like to watch that stuff on TV. I don't want to do that stuff. So please let us get on airplanes again sometime.
I had to repair my garbage disposal actually like this week. So the old one had a funny smell and burned out electrically. So it's like, okay, that's getting replaced. And we shipped one to the house and I did the work.
You didn't even have to go to Home Depot. You just had it.
Home Depot shipped it to the house. Because I made it a little easier by replacing it with the exact same model. So I didn't have to do quite all the same remounting. And with only one minor snafu, it was replaced. So I'm feeling all handy.
Well, I actually bought a new camera, and I normally don't have anything expensive sent to my house. That's what the UPS store is for. But I'm here, and I don't want to go to the store. So I had it shipped to my house, and it arrived without anybody stealing it off my front porch. So.
I tell you, my favorite current innovation of all of this is the I can order beer from the local beer store and they will deliver it into my car by pulling up and they will come on out and put it into my car. Wow. It's like that is a brilliant use of the combination of online shopping technology and texting.
Necessity as the mother of invention.
That is a great topic to bring up when we get to the life after the pandemic section.
Oh, totally.
There are innovations that will be around when all of this is over. So, all right, but that's not our first topic. Our first topic of today is kind of a community rant, which comes not from just one of us having a rant, but the three of us exchanging rant emails on the common theme of, is it your role as an MSP to be the bank and to loan money to your clients? That's somewhat of a sarcastic intro.
No, next topic. I mean, so I think, look, I'll start the first lob of a grenade into this one. If you're getting advice, right, and I were talking about a little bit of the prep, but if you're getting advice to somebody who has a very secure W-2 job and is telling you to help your customers through rough times, they're not the ones scrounging for the work and scrounging for like and they're not the ones whose neck are on the lines on the delivery. I'm gonna say this really boldly. People, labor is your number one expense. It is the one big thing that you've got to manage. Do not give that stuff away.
Well, and see, it goes to a very tactical place. This is not the philosophy of financial management and customer relationships. This is business management 101. Revenue is interesting. Margin is motivating. Cash is the only thing that matters. And if you are voluntarily reducing your cash flow for, as we discussed on a previous podcast, you're doing it in a way that's not going to save your customer. It might be a nice gesture, but it's not going to prevent them from going out of business, but it might cause you to experience the threat of going out of business. If that's what you're doing, my question is, then what? Like, what is your next move? Because that's not going to be a profit strategy for long, and that's also not going to be a platform from which you can invest to recover once this thing starts to turn back around. You need
Brian, you said last week that your example was the, you know, $800 is not going to save your client. I will give a slightly different variation of that. Let's say you got a client with 25 users and you cut their per device by $10. You save them $250 a month, $3,000 a year. If that saves their business, they were right on the margin anyway, right? So that's literally never going to save anybody. When, you know, Dave talks about labor is your biggest cost. If you got a technician that costs you $5,000 a month, then cutting your endpoints by $10 and having, let's say, 1,000 endpoints deployed, that cuts your income by $10,000 a month. And you will not save your clients, and you will kill your own business.
And I want to differentiate between the idea of offering a new lower cost service versus what we're talking about here, which is this idea of like, oh, I'm just going to help them out financially, or I'm going to discount. They are different moves. I am all for if a customer wants to cut their costs, because everyone's looking to cut costs, if you say, hey, we're going to reexamine the service you have, and we're going to offer a new, less expensive, less feature-rich service, that is a different statement. That is very smart management.
Right.
And I would assume, though, you are still factoring in your costs of delivering it and know that labor is your most expensive thing. If you're doing all that, I'm all for that. What I'm protesting is I'm hearing too often these statements of, well, you just need to be more generous with your terms, or you need
like forgiving.
Be forgiving. Last I checked, you know, your own employees, you know, are looking also to make sure that they have income coming in. Now, look, again, there is an element of people may be in it together, right? You may say, collectively, we know that if our industry is being decimated, we will collectively take less of a salary. That is a move that an organization may take together. Leadership may say we're cutting salaries to make sure that we don't have to cut people. Again, all smart internal moves. But if you're literally just going to a customer and saying, I'm going to cut your rates, that isn't doing the job.
And value selling 101 says that there is a relationship of give and take. If you want to get more, you need to pay more. And if you want to pay less, then that means you will get less. If you're maintaining the give and take, you can still rationalize a value position at a lower price point. But if you're giving the same level of service and charging less for it, you've broken the give and take relationship, and you've convinced your customer that what you do is not actually mission critical. Now, again, we mentioned last week, and I want to give some kudos. There are some manufacturers out there. We said the little guy on the front line selling human labor should not be the one offering, because it's not big enough and it's not sustainable. We look to our bigger partners in the value chain, the manufacturers, the software publishers, to bring more substantial programs. And a number of them are absolutely doing that. I have seen announcements from HPE, from Cisco, from a number of other manufacturers. The Microsoft folks are getting in on this on the software side. Substantial programs, billions of dollars that are being made available either for delaying payments, for reducing payments, for reducing the cost of maintenance contracts. Now, that is something that I can appreciate. I recognize the investment, and billions of dollars at a time, it might make a dent. You giving $250 at a time will only dent you.
Right. Well, and I want to point out that, like, I'm going to use an example, a concrete example. I'm doing it when we're recording this. I did it for today's podcast. You'll already have heard it on the Business of Tech. I'm going to give a concrete example. GE Healthcare and Microsoft are rolling out a new offering that is specifically, it's monitoring and management of healthcare equipment, specifically related to COVID-19. They are rolling it out at no cost through January 2021, except for the installation. Why? Because the installation is labor, everybody. these are the companies with the very, very deep pockets who are waiving the capital expenses of the equipment and the software, but no, they have to cover labor. So they're charging for installation. Remember that example by the companies that are in the best position to potentially have been a bank. And why do you think you're different?
I want to remind people, especially those who this is their first recession.
Yeah.
We're going to be in a recession. This is different than last time. Last time started with the banks disappearing and the government forcing one bank to buy another and some banks being taken over by the government. That's not what's going on this time. The banks are still there. The lending institutions are actually the ones that all of this money is being funneled through. They right now, today anyway, are strong. And some of them may fail. But right now, lending and financing are very powerful tools that are available to you. Help your clients with that, because at the end of the day, cash is king. And, you know, as we've said in various ways, labor is the single most important thing you have, and cash is absolutely the one thing you need to be conserving.
And just as a financing. I'm sorry, Carl. As a final note on this one from me, surviving is not enough. This is a two-part activity: survive and recover. Right? Like those two things both need to happen. And if you are giving away your position, your cash, your resources, when it moves out of the survive and don't go away phase, and you step into the recover and come back phase, what are you going to have to use to do that with? I want to make sure everybody is focused on survive and recover, not just part one.
So I think that tees this premise teases up nicely to have a conversation about an example of what we're talking about in terms of the thinking on opportunity. There has been a lot of people discussing there's all this opportunity out there. And I think first of this group may just go, not so simple. But I think what we want to delve into is some of the thinking on this idea of, there are opportunities. Because by the way, there are. I'm not saying that the market...
There's always opportunities.
There are less. Let's observe that. Just in general, there are less. And they are specific. And you need to seek them out. They're harder to find and they're specific. And we want to talk about an example here to give you a sense of where the misperception of opportunity is and how it is deeper than that. And let's start with education as our example. And the premise being is that there are some who have made statements like, with all of this move to remote learning, if there is so much opportunity in education at the university level, at the junior high, high school, elementary school, there's all this effort. And anybody who thinks it's not going to go back, like it's going to change forever. I think we want to talk a little bit about how that line of thinking is entirely flawed.
the devil is always in the details. This remote learning is great for super motivated students who are actually willing to go sign up for something and pay for it. There's always been online education, right? As somebody who runs an online, seminar business, I have people paying me for it every single month. But I don't see people saying, all of you extroverts who really love to hang out in the classroom and horse around, just go online, you'll be fine, right? And all of you third graders and all of you first graders and all of your kindergartners.
Let's start from the basic part of it. Not everyone has the internet connection, people. Like, this is completely exposed to the fact that the New York Times had a great piece about roughly a third of students do not have adequate connections to be able to even access remote learning. They're like not even on the table for them. And then additionally, there's very much a link to, you know, income level, to students being able to show up. The poorer you are, the less likely you are to be able to have the facilities to do this.
And like you say, right, need equals opportunity. Sometimes the marketplace can solve that. Sometimes the marketplace cannot solve it by itself. And you need an external resource to bring that in. I've said before when we've discussed technology and education, I come from a world of educators, right? Like my daughter is an elementary school teacher. My family contains educators. My sister teaches high school. This is a mindset that I have had for a very long time. And I am personally fascinated by all of the classroom and instructional technology that is available to enhance the learning experience, whether that is makerspace stuff, 3D printing, programming tools, esports. There are phenomenal opportunities to radically advance the experience with technology if you know how to teach with those tools.
Right.
Now, that is, you can have all of that technology in the world. You can have all the Chromebooks, all of the makerspaces. You can have all of the tools in the world. And if you do not teach and support and motivate the teachers how to teach in that environment, it's all just a bunch of fancy tools sitting on a cart in the back of the room collecting dust. And that's not a hypothetical situation. Radical amounts of money have been spent on tools through the one-to-one initiative, through E-Rate, through a lot of things in the education marketplace that just simply don't get deployed and used. Now, is Zoom a good tool? Depends on whether or not you're a professional who can provide security around it. Hint, hint. Is distance learning a viable platform? As Carl said, yes, for some people with certain styles and with certain things. But none of the connectivity, the collaboration, the Google Classroom, the technology, none of it makes a single bit of difference unless the professionals in that environment can and want to teach that way. You could sell them all the tools in the world. Can you teach the teachers how to teach in that environment? If you can't, selling them all the tools in the world is just going to piss them off.
And let's also take this from an economic perspective, right? You have to be motivated to do this because, and so I'm going to come at it. You came at it really well from the broad sense in a public education perspective. I'm going to make a point around university level education, which at some level is private, right? That's ultimately it's state funded, but
the most mature.
Right. But it is the most mature. It's really easy to make the statement of, oh, well, all these universities are going to go online. Well, let me tell you what happens in that sense, because the moment you do that, the moment everyone is online, you have removed the scarcity of education. The reason higher education has a level of value to it at the point it does, and it charges the level it does, is there is a scarcity. They've created what can be viewed very much as luxury brands. You can only get into MIT, Harvard, Princeton, because they have limited physical space to offer that. But if you go virtual, you now have infinite space. So you've taken away the scarcity. Are you going to pay the same rates to send your child off to Zoom version of MIT? No, you're not. And then it also makes the competitive nature of these schools entirely differently. The local school is not going to look nearly as good as MIT, who can deliver it online from your home, meaning the top players are going to quickly dominate the entire space by their name recognition, their quality of education, their ability to do that, and they are going to crush the rest of the market. So somebody who just goes, oh, there's all this opportunity and all this new remote working, has not done any of the math or any of the homework to look at the market.
And this is actually not a technical issue.
Right.
The technical piece has been figured out, but look around. All of these community colleges are putting out horrible education. The students are bored to tears. Nobody's paying any attention. And in the meantime, there are lots of online, the University of Phoenix, this is not an ad, but University of Phoenix has been doing this for a long time. They have a system for teaching the teachers how to do instruction over the internet. They have a way to, like, this is how you lay out exams. This is how you do all these things. In the meantime, other people are just trying to flounder around and figure out how to do this because they've never had any instruction on it. They don't know how to teach online. And so you hand them, you can hand them the best tools in the world, and they will not be able to produce a good product that anybody's willing to pay for.
So yep. You're exactly right. This is not a technology problem. That's a technology opportunity. It is a content slash product problem. It is an economics problem. It is a marketing problem, right? You remember the days when universities actually had to send recruiters to high schools to motivate kids to want to come to their school? You had university fairs, you all them set up their thing, like, no, please come to my school, please come to my school. And then everybody decided to go to a school, and every university had far more applicants than they could accommodate. It's going to put that shoe back on the other foot. And universities, to Dave's point, they're going to have to learn how to compete again. They're going to have to learn how to market and sell their wares, and cannot simply take it for granted that, well, more students will apply than we could possibly do. We're in the cat's seat. We're just going to charge more, and that will balance out the economics. Not anymore. Got to learn how to sell. Got to learn how to compete.
So the point of this topic is to say, look, what we've identified is an opportunity. Education has the opportunity to be disrupted by technology. But saying technology alone is going to just do it has oversimplifies to a level of insanity. And so I'm just counseling everyone out there who's hearing pundits around saying, well, there's all this opportunity for technology. Sure, there is opportunity here, but recognize that it is intense and sometimes intensely destructive to the existing infrastructure. And that does not mean opportunity for all. It does not mean you're just going to take the existing thing, put tech around it, and you're done. I rant against business digital transformation. This is the very definition of digital transformation. It changes the market entirely. Don't just assume, I can just go sell them tech because now they're online. Not the answer.
We will revisit some version of this again because, you know, part of what we've talked about in both of the topics today is you got to know what your market is, right? You can't treat every client the same. Some of them are going to survive this and some will not. Some institutions will survive and some will not. Some methods will survive and some will not.
Totally.
So topic number three, we're doing our ongoing series on technology after the pandemic. And today's topic specifically is about the changing role of robots. And in particular, that robots, I believe, will be more welcome after this, at least some robots. And the article that we're going to point to is about, hey, robots with AI helping in recycling programs because people don't want to touch that stuff you've discarded.
Well, it makes my burrito robot so relevant, doesn't it? Like right now, I could desperately use a burrito robot to bring me a fresh burrito to my house. Like it's right. So
as somebody who eats out more than I should, believe me, I am suffering for restaurants to open up again.
Oh, totally. And it's those little things, but it gives you a lot of insight into, you know, the thinking of, yes, a lot's going to change because what we're learning is the elements that are difficult to do. And we've definitely exposed a lot of sections of our economy and of our system where there's a lot more critical infrastructure that is very much powered by humans that is worth examining. We get in the DeLorean, we go back a year, and you told somebody, well, you know what? Who's going to become vitally important? Grocery stockers.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think any of us would have seen that one coming.
Well, and now the robots are stocking the groceries so that the people, the humans, can run around squirting antiseptic on everything and cleaning the grocery store.
Right.
And again, this is where the opportunity, I believe, will persist and it will present tremendous value opportunity for people who do what we do for a living. Not just selling you a robot, a device, but also doing the software integration so that it is connected and monitorable and controllable, but also infusing it with intelligence, whether that is AI or AR type technologies. The robot needs to be able to understand its environment. It needs to be able to respond to contextual situations. Automation is the execution of robots, right? I think automation is going to become, it's not new. This is absolutely not the first time any of us have talked about it, but it will leapfrog from potential use case scenarios into the mainstream as a result of the things that we have done. Right now, one of them that I saw in the grocery environment, a robot that goes up and down the aisles, scans the barcodes on the fronts of the shelf, measures the stock in, stock out level, and does all of that reordering. That's a job that I did in college on a graveyard shift. I walked up and down the aisles with a pen and I scanned the barcodes, and I did that stuff when I was a much younger individual. And a machine not only can do that thing much more cost effectively than we could do it, much more accurately as well, because trust me, on the graveyard shift, I was not the most accurate individual at math and tabulation, but also much more safely, right? Because they're not going to present the sterilization problems that come with humans. That is not just a robot. That is not just the data control and management of that robot. That is the automation of a business process. None of that stuff comes in a box. That requires a systems integrator. That requires a managed service provider. There's a hardware resale, a software license. All of this stuff comes together. The value added business of technology is mission critical for the way forward around robots.
And we're actually, I mean, what's interesting to think about it this way is you're also solving for, I'll just say the theoretical COVID-22 or COVID-27. Like
we will be prepared next time.
Right, exactly. Is what we're learning now is the fundamental changes that we're going to need to make to these portions of the system, because the other side doesn't look like what we left. The other side looks like something different. And we are now looking for the opportunities to make this easier to do. You know, for example, I don't expect it to be in a grocery store that is designed the way that it is ever again. Once they start building new ones, they will be designing new styles where you don't have to be as close to people, that it is more automated in terms of delivery. You're going to be rethinking these processes. Robots are going to make a big difference in this. This doesn't eliminate human. What it does is it says, I can take these pieces and make it safer for humans.
Well, and to borrow an old example that we're all familiar with in the business literature, this is not simply about improving the buggies and buggy whips of today. It is about inventing the capabilities of tomorrow. No, nobody knows what that grocery store of the future is going to look like yet, but you're 100% right. It cannot just be a slightly more automated, improved version of today's grocery store.
Right.
It needs to be reimagined.
For me, I think the biggest thing here is that, you know, we've all known that we have to go through these phases where robots are introduced, they are resisted, and then eventually they are accepted. And I think that one of the things coming out of this little economic downturn is going to be the wider acceptance of robots across the board for sorting, packing, inventory, you know, whatever. And I think on many, many fronts, we're going to see, it's not eliminating jobs. I mean, that was always the big fear. And so far, robots haven't eliminated any jobs.
Resistance is futile.
and they may yet eliminate those jobs. But in the meantime, the resistance, I think, is fading. And as we come out of this and we start hiring people back, you know, to fix robots and to do new jobs that were created by the robots, I think it's huge. And the fact that it's the AI that makes the difference is huge, because we are literally, we've talked since the beginning of this podcast, we are at this point where many things are becoming mature at the same time, and AI plus robots is huge.
Yep. Yeah. And what is required? And this is where, again, back to our premise of the business of technology is not just people who make technology or people who buy and use it. It's also the people who sell it, integrate it, support it, make it all work. And all three of those pieces are mandatory for the success of anything in the business of technology. That is where we are going to see an entirely new world of opportunity. I've been fascinated for years at the idea of automating business processes that are based on knowledge work, using software to define the conditions and automate the process that once was required for a human to do, but now can be done by software. Those things will absolutely keep expanding in our world. But what's fascinating is how they will be then attached to the hardware, the robot device, to do physical tasks, not just software tasks. That is going to be, I think, a brand new world. And this is going to accelerate the acceptance of it, as we all learned in the movie iRobot years ago. The three laws are not enough to save us.
Right. And we dove in specifically on a couple of examples here. I think this is the point of the exercise is also to think you can abstract this to other ones. Per our point in the education discussion, do not think this is just throwing technology at the existing solution. This is a transformative exercise. The thing on the other side will look different. That's a good thing, but it doesn't necessarily, the opportunity is not just transform what's there.
Well, the other thing is, just to wrap it all up, Dave, when you talk about people saying, oh, this is, everything's an opportunity. Boy, there literally is nothing but opportunity, but you gotta figure out the right opportunities, right?
Right.
Every one of us, everybody listening to this podcast should be able to improve their business in the next 6 months and come out the other end with a better business, a more modern business focused on the future.
Yep. But be skeptical of somebody that just says, oh, there's opportunity everywhere. Because what that means is that they have not spent the time to actually think about what that means.
What it really means is they have a quota to hit and they would really like you to sell some units for them.
That's so true.
By the way, I can't let this go. Ryan used the term business of tech and didn't say trademark Dave Sobel.
That's true. Subscribe at msbradio.com.
Dave Sobel.
Very good. Thank you all for listening. And this has been episode 56 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.